Just need to check the sound levels. Could you say what you had for breakfast?
I would love to. I went to Greg's for the first time.
Really?
I'd never been to Greg's. Is that a thing?
It's a huge thing. It's a cult here.
It's a... and it was flaky. That would be the word I would use. I would say it was flaky. And I had... It was sausage and bean and cheese inside like a square.
A whole breakfast.
Yeah, it was a whole breakfast in a square. And I did it because as I ran from the show... It was just, like, so much to roll out of bed, not shower, do the show, meet a guy from the press, and then be like, I need to do a podcast. And so I stopped at Greg's for a bottle of water. Today is actually my catch-up day. I need to, like, grocery shop and, like, get...
Just more domesticity. Fruit.
Yeah, yeah. I signed up for a package of yoga, so I'm going to go to yoga, like, tomorrow, maybe.
He's a full-on clown. He's turning into Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah, man.
That's who you remind me of.
Yeah, I'm sure she starts her morning day with Greg's.
Similar length beard, too. She doesn't like to mention that, but...
She's got a great team. Yeah, so that's what I had for breakfast. I had Greg's.
Fantastic. Hello and welcome to Spieling the Beans with me, Dom Steve. It's the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. Not to be confused with architectural podcasts in which story builders tell stories about building stories. My guest this week is a New York-based narrative comedian whose Edinburgh Fringe debut hour, entitled The Whole Thing, A True Story of Love, Comedy and Rice Cakes, has seen him be compared with a young Mike Birbiglia. He's been featured on the NPR BBC Radio 4 storytelling show The Moth, has written jokes for the New York Video Game Awards, and is host of the ever-popular Funniest People I Met This Month comedy show in Queens, New York. We spoke in the bedroom of his flat one afternoon, beginning moments before a pigeon apparently attempted suicide by flying into his window. You'll hear it. And in this, our longest episode of the show so far, our conversation covers such diverse areas as why narrative-based comedy is more common at Edinburgh rather than New York, why someone who did a music degree intentionally doesn't do musical comedy, how the internet has affected live storytelling, and why Danny Champion of the World is the best Roald Dahl book. So ladies and gentlemen, please welcome my guest for this week, storyteller extraordinaire, Gabe Mollica. Gabe, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. This is so exciting. We met in the Mash House.
We did.
And I, you know, I was just trying to get you to come to the show, and I didn't think that you'd end up on my bed.
To clarify, to record the podcast.
To record the podcast. Yeah, clothes are on. It's, but it is an adventure. Edinburgh is sort of, you never know where you're going to end up with what people.
It does seem to be a...
Whoa.
We appear to have... been subject to a burglary live on the podcast.
Was that a bird?
That might have been
a bird hitting the window.
I'm not sure if you could hear that, listeners, but there. What would that look? There's a that's bird poo. Unless it was just a really like ferocious.
But how does bird poo get on a vertical space?
They defy all laws of physics.
Do you think that bird flew into my window and then shit at the same time?
I mean, I would if I flew into a window.
Yeah.
Bowels would be evacuated.
Weird.
Anyway. I hope he's all right. This is probably the first podcast we're recording to come from a warning from RSPB.
Yeah.
No animals were knowingly harmed in the recording of the show.
Yeah, we tried our best to to save the animals.
Well, talking about Edinburgh, it does seem to have this sort of reverential feel amongst comedians around the world. Why do you think it has that image?
I guess the corporate answer is, like, we're the biggest arts festival in the world. That's sort of, like, how they boast themselves. I think it's a cool place because, in terms of the English-speaking comedy culture, it's sort of the place where everyone from all the parts of the world that do comedy come together. So, like, already Australian, New Zealand, America, Canada, all over the UK and Ireland, I've just met comics from all over, and... because of the internet and because of Netflix, we all sort of have the same influences in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And yet there are these distinct sort of flavors of stand-up that I've been just seeing in the 10 shows I've seen so far. And so everybody, it's just a cool place to share. And, you know, audiences are hit and miss. I've been very lucky so far. But I think people come in hopes of just, like, sharing more. I mean, I know Like, there are some people that want to get an agent out of this or want a tour out of this, but this is sort of my first Fringe, and the show is very personal. It's about Edinburgh. So for me, it's a little bit more about sharing this one story that I've been writing for a couple years than it is about any of those other things. But yeah, it is very reverential. I would use that word. I've always sort of, it's been my only goal in comedy to come here. I've been telling people when I get back I might quit, because this has been the goal the whole time since I started 5 years ago, is to bring a narrative, Mike Birbiglia-style show to Edinburgh. And I'm doing it, and it's I need to take more time, I think, to appreciate that I'm here and that I'm playing to audiences every night. I have some friends that are sort of reminding me. It's like, it's crazy that you're here. And we've done, I did six shows so far, 6-hour-long shows plus, like, all the spots I've been doing. But that's we're a quarter of the way through the Fringe, which feels, and by, in 2 days, will be 8, 16, 24, we'll be a third of the way through in 2 days, which wow. feels absolutely bananas.
Does it feel like it's racing past?
It does. In the first couple of days, I was dragging, and I thought, like, oh no, I'm going to be so tired, and I'm not going to know how to do this. But you just learn so, from what I've learned from a week ago to now, I am just a totally different Fringe person. So just everything from flyering. So, like, we met because I went up to you and said, hey, I think I said, are you here to see any shows? Something like that.
Mm-hmm. You said we look alike.
yeah, I have a couple. There's a couple things that I'll say. Somebody's wearing American things, I'll come talk to them. But on the first day, I just sort of indiscriminately handed out flyers for my show on the street. I made some jokes. I would say, this is my life's work, or this is all I have, or whatever. And I was getting laughs, and I was getting people taking the flyers. But that night, I had 9 people. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I don't know why I expected this, but I expected just like a bunch of people. And I was like, oh, okay, this is hard. Mm-hmm. And slowly over the next 2 days, I was like, oh, well, maybe I need to like talk to people a little bit more. And so I just, it happened, you know, sort of slowly, but now I've gotten pretty good at coming up to somebody and saying, hey, are you here to see a show? Oh, you're seeing the Cambridge Footlights. Well, 5 minutes after their show is my show. Or just like finding out where people are from, because mm-hmm. my show is, the way I pitch my show is I say I used to live in Edinburgh, so if they're from Edinburgh, we have a way in, and if they're not from Edinburgh, maybe we'll talk about that. Mm-hmm. But just in terms of becoming friendly with new people, I've sort of learned the Edinburgh culture of, you can talk to people. Where in New York, people tell you to just, like, fuck off. Or, like, you wouldn't even, I've talked to more people in the last week, more strangers than I have in my entire life living in New York. Like, no joke. And wow. Just in terms of meaningful conversation. Just in terms of, like you getting to know someone well enough, a stranger, that 2 days later, they're sitting on your bed recording a podcast. Like, that really doesn't happen in New York. Not without a murder investigation. But also, I don't know if it happens in Edinburgh all the time either, because I lived here for a year, and I was maybe a little bit more shy, but I think there's something about the festival, and comedians and theater kids and magicians or whatever, as a group, were a little bit more open, and were a little bit more willing, perhaps, especially when we get around each other to share. And audience members, like, I met these two girls last night who were like, I tried to pitch them on the show, and they're like, oh, no, we're here to see you. And I was like, that was, like, the best feeling I'd ever had.
Wow.
And they were like, yeah, we just combed through the Fringe guide, and we saw your show, and we thought we'd come. We just got in from Australia this morning. And I was like, this is so cool. So, like, if I weren't on the hustle and wasn't trying to get people in, I would have just assumed that they, I don't know, showed up by accident or whatever. And it's cool. It's one of the fun things about being a new artist at the Fringe, a new comedian at the Fringe, is that you're anonymous, mm-hmm. and so I feel like I have a secret, which is like my show's good, and you'll leave feeling good about yourself or knowing more about me in some sort of meaningful way, and it's funny. Where like these more established acts, it's probably, must be heaven to wake up every day, you don't have to hand anyone a flyer, mm-hmm. you walk on stage and you perform for 150 people, and then you go see shows. That mm-hmm. must be the easiest gig in the world. But the anonymity of, trust me, come to the show. If you don't like it, I'll give you £5, which is not true, but I try to get people in that way. Mm-hmm. And the anonymity so far has been, it's the scariest part, but it's also the part that makes me feel like, oh, like, you might be in for a treat or a surprise if you come to my show. And so I believe in it in a way that's sort of, that I think is overall helpful to the whole experience.
Well, you mentioned there about the difference between New York and Edinburgh. How is it in terms of comedy styles? Does it differ from the American sensibility or the East Coast sensibility to a British audience?
Yeah, absolutely. So New York, in a lot of ways, people... I was just talking to a guy from Australia, and I was like, have you been to New York to do comedy? He's like, no, it's my dream. Like, that's what I really want to do. So in a lot of ways, it's like the mecca of comedy. There's so much comedy, and there's so much different types of comedy. There's the club scene. There's sort of like the hipster, gay Brooklyn scene that I'm like sort of so in awe of, that like I go to those shows, but like don't know that crew necessarily. There's the improv scene. So there's lots of cool stuff in New York. In terms of the hardened traditional stand-up culture of club comedy in New York, most comedy is 15-minute sets that are just bits. Very rarely is it a story. It's more often just a joke, whether that's based off the news or based off a sort of a trope or whatever it is. In America, for the most part, folks are interested in just like funny people doing funny stuff. So, example, we have a couple great American comics who are over here now who are just doing an hour of bits. There's a little connective tissue, but it's not a story. So like Dan Soder, one of my favorites, he's doing a show here, and he's done my show in New York, and he's just like so good. I saw him, he did my show, he did a half hour, and just killed for a half hour. Everyone was like on cloud nine from having watched this guy perform. And I saw him over here, and the audience really liked him, but I've seen him like just like annihilate a room. So I think he's doing well, but I don't know if he's doing as well when I saw him do 75 minutes for a packed out show in Brooklyn for him. So I would say like the main difference that I've been noticing is that in New York, I guess it's about bits and chunks of material that like somewhat relate. And over here, people are a little bit more willing to listen to a story, to have either a theme of your hour or a conceit. The guy I just met has a show where he did a journal every day for a year on playing cards, and then he shuffles them, and somebody picks a playing card, reads a journal entry, and he'll tell the story from that thing. Aiden Taco Jones, I believe is his name. So that's a thing that would be like real gimmicky in New York comedy, and over here that's like a moderate shtick. So I think people over here are a little bit more likely to listen to a story. And in America, like, we have some comedians who have really started to cross that border a little bit. My favorite being Mike Birbiglia. There's also Hasan Minhaj had a solo show that I loved called Homecoming King.
Yeah.
Yeah, incredible.
Phenomenal.
Yeah, I saw him do it in New York.
Oh, wow.
At NYU. So he's doing, and at certain points he switches languages.
Mm.
And New York being a super diverse place, there are people that, so he's giving an emotional climax in that show, and then he'll flip languages, and there are people behind me gasping before he gets to the punchline in English, and I'm like, this is incredible. This is like the coolest, most New York multicultural thing in the world. So Birbiglia, Hasan Minhaj, Jacqueline Novak has a show right now at the Cherry Lane, which is my favorite theater.
Yes, something about kneeling down.
Yes, get on your knees. Yes. It's a show about blowjobs.
Oh, right.
And I've seen her. It's cool. One of the things about New York is I saw her at this, like, there's a sort of infamous New York City storytelling mic every week called The Dump. And the guy that runs it is this guy, Jake, and he's like a curmudgeon. And he pretends to be all hardened, or he doesn't pretend. That's like sort of who he is. He's sort of hardened, and like he used to drink, and now he doesn't drink anymore. And he says, like, we want to hear your stories about drugs or prostitutes. And I always go up there and be like, here's my story about musical theater. And then one time he came up after me and was like, so I also used to do musical theater. And I was like, I knew it. But anyway, I one time saw Jackie Novak like run a 8-minute story at The Dump.
Wow.
That ended up 6 months later being off Broadway.
Wow.
So it's just like one of these cool things that like you never know in the scene. But again, the storytelling scene, particularly the comedy storytelling scene, is small in New York, or smaller than the larger stand-up scene. But it is the stuff that I like. So like I got into stand-up. I've always been a huge fan of stand-up, but I got into stand-up because of those long stories. Because I just liked following along. Mm-hmm. As a kid, I was read to a lot. That was sort of like my mom's like thing. It was like every night she would read to us. And I think that pattern of just being told a story is very comforting to me. And I love to laugh, and I'll just go to a stand-up show and like watch whoever. But for me, it really hits home when I get to a new place, when I feel like this has been crafted and thought and is thoughtful and considered and has a little bit something else to say. That's a somewhat controversial opinion in New York. There's a lot of comedians that are like, fuck that, like that's BS, like, oh, you want me to cry on stage, like... I just want to tell jokes, and I respect that. And there are probably parts of my show. There are probably parts of my show, now that I'm being honest, there are probably parts of my show that I sacrifice being as funny as humanly possible for like a slight moment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've worked really, really hard to make sure it's really funny and that there are these like tentpole jokes, so we never go too long without a punchline.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have a story to tell. And Birbiglia talks about sometimes you have to cut a joke that will work because it doesn't fit the story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really delicate balance. And that's a controversial balance, but it's one that I'm willing to fight for because I think overall I want to have a show that does both. And I think you can. And in Edinburgh, I'm noticing that people are more interested and involved in that type of comedy show. Because, like, everybody's funny, for the most part at this festival, right? Like, everybody's a comedian and has done hundreds of sets and tries really hard. So to stand out, I think, you sort of have to have a thing. But for me, that's just, I just like a long story.
What was your favorite book that your mum read to you as a child?
Oh, that's a great question. It's a British book.
Oh,
it's,
really? Is it Harry Potter?
It's not Harry Potter, though we did read that together. My favorite was this book by, I'm talking to a Brit and I'm going to ruin the pronunciation of this famous
person. It may be treasonous.
Roald Dahl? Is that how you pronounce
spot
it?
On. Yeah, Roald Dahl. I think.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, and illustrations by Quentin Blake.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite one was one that's a little bit off the beaten path. There's no movie or anything, which is, it's called Danny the Champion of the World.
Yeah.
I love that book.
Wow. That is a niche. Oh. Even within Roald Dahl, that is a niche favorite.
It's the best one.
What do you like about it?
It's a kid who lives with his dad in a caravan, and there's just something very sweet and underdoggy about it. And then he finds out his dad has this nighttime hobby outside of raising him, which is that he hunts pheasants. But he does it in a non-violent way. He doesn't just shoot the pheasants. He he tricks them with raisins. And there's something about, there's something about discovering that your parents have bigger parts of their lives that are sometimes a little mischievous or deviant or funny or quirky or weird or troublesome. That's really enchanting. And that, like, by finding out what his dad is actually up to, he doesn't love him less. He, like, loves him more, which is, like, this sort of, like, really charming thing. And also, like, Roald Dahl does a really good job at, like, describing the rich guy in the Rolls Royce who, like, owns all the pheasants in a really, like, accurate way that I think if you know the issues of class around the world, like, Roald Dahl, like, sort of illustrates the issues of class really beautifully. It was actually, do you guys have senior yearbook quotes in this part of the world?
We're very aware of them. We sometimes have them.
I see.
But we've grown up with all of your John Hughes films.
Yes, yeah.
And High School Musicals. Oh, so we're very
so
aware
you're familiar.
Of that.
Yeah, that's funny. I do a joke that requires you to know about baseball, like very little, mm-hmm. but everyone's like, yeah, we know baseball. We don't watch it or know the rules, but like we know it exists. So my high school yearbook quote was a quote from Danny the Champion of the World. It was, and in retrospect, now that I do comedy, I regret that I didn't pick a funny one, I guess, but the quote was, the most exciting things we do in our lives are the things that scare us the most. They wouldn't be exciting if they didn't. Which I guess is a comedy quote now that I think about
it's a
it.
Perfect one.
Because comedy is can be terribly exciting and terribly terrifying.
Do you find it scary?
You know, there are flashes of it. There's a middle part of my show where I talk about musical theater. There's like sort of an extended thing. And it's not too long, and there are jokes about me in that world and like being like an overly dramatic theater kid. But there's a point every night I'm like, well, if they don't like this first musical theater joke, or by the second one, like this could be a long 10 minutes. So there's like a slight fear in that regard. But I'm also a relatively confident performer, and I've done it enough times now to know that for the most part, I do okay. And I think I try when I get up there to make people feel calm. They don't worry for me. Because again, I grew up doing musical theater and shows and stuff that I think I have a way about me on stage where I don't get like visibly nervous.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to calm people down where they're like not worried for me. So yes, there are moments that are terrifying that are sort of variable, but for the most part, I get up there and I'm just excited to share if the audience is willing to meet me there. I think that's why I was talking to you the other day that on Sunday night, I had an audience of four. And they were all people I knew, and mm-hmm. I had dinner with them 4 hours earlier, and it was the best show of my life. I did it without the microphone, and they listened, and they knew the outline of the story, but they didn't know
The detail?
They didn't know any of the details, really. And it was so the crowd was my friend Mahmood, who's actually seen the show before, but the three others were this woman I worked with in Scotland, this teacher, mm-hmm. and her two daughters, one who's about to go to uni and one who's a year away from graduating. And so, yeah, I did the story for them. And, like, I opened with, would you pass the broccoli? Because it felt like we were at dinner again. So that was sort of fun. Yeah, so no, to answer your question, no, I don't get nervous, but there are flashes of it for sure.
You mentioned musical theater a lot, and you did a musical degree, is that right?
I studied music for a Bachelor of Arts degree, so it was like a broad music degree. I had a particular focus, which was some musical theater, some choral singing, and like a little bit of opera.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but it doesn't seem as though musical comedy is particularly your niche on stage. Why have you decided to not include what is clearly a big part of your life in the comedic output?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. I think one of the reasons is that I came at music was always like a respite for me in a lot of ways. In the show, I talk about how it was the place where I belonged when I didn't feel like I belonged in other places. And so it always sort of has felt that way. And I did it until I was 22. In college, I was singing 20 hours a week. Barbershop quartets, choirs, a cappella groups, everything. And then when I moved here, which sort of gets into the show, the pitch of the show is that my best friend and my girlfriend fell in love, and the next day I started to do stand-up comedy. So I was still singing when I was over here, and I was taking piano lessons, but suddenly, without the community here, without the community of other people doing music with that I knew and loved, it wasn't filling me in the same way, and comedy was something I could do alone. So that's one of the reasons that I've transitioned. But in terms of musical comedy, for me now, when I play the piano or I play the guitar and sing, it's a time to just sort of unwind mm-hmm. and reflect. And one of the reasons I didn't pursue, really the only reason I didn't pursue music is because I'm such a terrible piano player that I wanted to teach choir, but I wasn't good enough to play the piano and read the lyrics and teach kids at the same time. I just like couldn't juggle all mm-hmm. three of those things. And I always knew that if I became a choir teacher, even though like I could do it, I would have been okay. I would have figured it out. I knew I wouldn't be as good as I wanted to, and I might not ever. The other thing that was frustrating about music is that there are some people who are savants. There are 5-year-old kids that can play the piano better than I'll be able to do anything ever. And in comedy, pretty much everybody starts at the same level. Lewis Black is a famous American comic, didn't become famous till his like 60s.
I didn't know it was that late on.
Yeah. Maybe his 50s, but he was like a playwright. So in comedy, everybody's sort of, like, there's no funny 15-year-old in any sort of meaningful way. Or they are, but they're, like, a YouTube thing. Like, there's something about live performance of comedy mm-hmm. that takes experience and dedication and craft and life experience sort of all, like, spiraling at the same time. Mm-hmm. Where in music, it felt frustrating sometimes that I didn't, my parents read to me, they didn't force me to play the piano an hour a day, and so I always felt behind. And so I knew that if I was going to pursue music, that I might not ever get to be as good as I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. Where when I started to write comedy, I was like, oh, there's sort of no ceiling. Like if I just keep working at it, I might be as good as I fear that I could be, mm-hmm. which is like a scary sort of thought. Like, no, the only thing holding you back is not trying, but like you could do it. So for me at this point, like when I play the piano, it's to sing and feel good about, or to unwind.
You need to keep the two worlds separate.
Yeah.
To keep you sane.
Yes. I took a songwriting class in college, and the song I wrote was like, it was a love, it's so funny, it was a love song that had jokes in it. And in retrospect, I was like, oh yeah, of course it was a love song. That's like what my comedy is. It's like, it's like a love story with jokes in it, or it's like a friendship story with a lot of jokes. So yeah, I try to keep those things separate, but it's still very important to me. It's a huge part of my show. So people that, I don't advertise it really anywhere, but people who have a theater background tend to like my show because mm-hmm. I talk a lot about performing in like the middle act.
So how do you approach, what's your writing process for writing a set?
That's a great question. So it always starts with jokes.
Key component.
Yeah. It always starts with like things I think are funny. So for me, like I sort of have these like big swaths of things that I write jokes about. One of them is my body and like how I look and how I feel. Another one is love, love and sex and dating is like a big chunk, but like my version of it. So I do a big thing about how I think cuddling is more intimate than sex. So I talk about like what that means. Mm. So it always starts with jokes, but also there's these sort of key stories of my life that I have been pretty good at mining and sort of doing over and over again. So one of the fun things about doing comedy is that every performance is like a final exam, and then it all goes out the window and you just do it again. So over the course of the last few years, I'll get booked to do a storytelling show, and I'll work really, really, really hard on this high school story about being in this one musical, and I sort of have like an overall arc of it. And depending on all the variables, it will change. So if it's a 5-minute story and the theme is music, like on The Moth, it'll be that version of the story. But if it's a 10-minute version and I can pick my theme, maybe I'll incorporate some other thing or incorporate a joke. So the story from the high school story involves me trying to lose weight to play this character. So independently of that, I've been doing jokes about rice cakes and how I eat them to lose weight and I don't like them and I shit on them for 4 minutes. So I might take
not
some of those.
Not literally, we should point out.
Yes, not literally. That would be incredible. what a joke. I'll take those rice cake bits and I'll take that story about trying to lose weight and I'll just sort of combine them. And I'll find a way to do exposition in the story with these already written jokes. Mm-hmm. So I'm sort of taking different parts of the hard stand-up that I try to do and the longer, more emotional storytelling and sort of smash them together. And for me, that's sort of like the winning combination. But again, it's all about that final exam, and you build and build and build, and you do the 10-minute show, and then you sort of take a step back. And then as I was putting together this show, this is a show that has taken shape over the last 6 months, that the first version was a half hour, mm-hmm. and it was all out of order. And I do it now in the complete opposite order. Wow. I used to open with the big story and then go back in time and tell the little stories. Now I do it all in chronological order with sort of flashbacks.
So a big crescendo.
Yeah, it sort of builds to that big moment. And even since the biggest change I made was from day one of The Fringe to day two, mm-hmm. where I would open with sort of I had these three topics of jokes. It was like jokes about my first name, my last name, jokes about me and food, jokes about me and relationships. And then I would start to tell the story. Mm-hmm. And I discovered after the first day, I was like, that worked. All those jokes are fine. But what I want to do is I want to tether those jokes to the stories that make most sense with them. So I just split up those three things. So I took the name joke and I put it in. Well, I got introduced to my friend Tim, and I do this joke about how my name is Gabe, so when people meet me, sometimes they think that I'm gay because they think I'm saying, hi, I'm gay, but what I'm saying is, hi, I'm Gabe. So I have that joke. So I just threw that into, when I met Tim, he thought I was gay because I attached that on there. The food stuff, when I'm talking about being a chubby middle schooler doing musical theater, I took all those rice cakes and I have a joke about McDonald's and I have a joke about body fat percentage and I just tethered all that to that story. And then I have a joke about yo-yos and sex that like is a weird funny joke, I hope, and a joke about cuddling.
Into.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no shame here.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I tethered that to meeting this girl that was really important to me. And so I've been calling it the Nicholson edit because I live on Nicholson Road or Nicholson Square.
Not to do with Jack.
So this is the Nicholson edit, and then slowly, then in the last couple of days, I've been working on the ending. Mm-hmm. So I have all these lines that sort of like culminate the show, and I'm trying to figure out the order of those like sort of powerful, funny, meaningful lines. And to this, even tonight, I'm going to try a new order and a new thing. And I have a friend here, his name is Brett Johnson, who has a show about being polyamorous.
Okay.
He used to be an evangelical Christian who was married at 21 and then it became a polyamorous marriage.
Quite a gear shift.
Yes. And it's a good pitch. People have been coming. It's a good show. Yeah. And he came the other night and gave me a bunch of tips where it was like, using too many people's names, just like, give us only the names you need, stuff like that. That's been really helpful. So from day one to day six, the show is totally different. Not totally different, but for me, it's totally different. And I actually had friends come on day one, and these two random British guys came, and we hung out afterwards. And I told them, come back on the last night and see how much the show has shifted. Mm. So that's another sort of fun tidbit.
What is the best advice you have received about comedy, and what is the worst advice?
The best advice has been to... I'll say this with a grain of salt. The best advice is to just like do it. I know that's like sort of cliched, but you got to get up a bunch. So the way I started was I made a big announcement on Facebook because I need to do that in order to like shame myself into following through. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm going to do stand up 100 times. And if I don't like it after 100 times, I'm going to stop. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a blog about it that I sort of never fully followed through on, but I would do sets and then I would keep a journal. And I would show everybody, these are the jokes I tried, this one worked, this one was horrible. And the reason it ended up failing was because it became a little bit too meta, where I was like talking about the thing I was doing as opposed to just doing it.
Yeah.
But that's like, so if you want to do stand-up or you want to do stories and go to story mics, just try it 100 times. And if you don't like it or you're not getting better, you can find something else. But for me, 100 just seemed like a meaningful number. The worst advice, there's so much bad advice. My least favorite is like when people are like, oh, don't do that, then you'll get labeled as a, like, oh, don't do that mic, you'll get labeled as like a guy who does that mic. And I'm just like, why don't we not worry about how like these like amorphous, like invisible things are gonna might label us and just try to get better at the thing. I think it was Bo Burnham who was like, don't get good at the thing. Don't get good at marketing the thing before you can do the thing. So I was explaining to you before we started the podcast that like there were some, I didn't send my press release to all the people that I should have, and I didn't submit to the Comedy Awards, and I didn't like play ball in the way that like somebody who's really trying to like make a living out of this does. But I'm okay with that because I know I was focused on the material, and then when I come back with my second show in 2 years, hopefully, I'll know a little bit more about how to do those sort of more corporate-y things. I'm also very blessed to have a job that I like in New York. I work in a school, and I have good hours. And so I don't need to monetize this right away. I have health insurance. I can just sort of, like, do it for the art's sake. And then at one point in my life, if when I want to take that leap, I can. So, like, my cousin Devin, who writes for The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, for a long time worked at an insurance company. And he worked really hard, and he was doing comedy all night and writing pilots and doing all types of comedy stuff. And then he got an offer to have an unpaid internship at The Onion.
Wow.
Yeah, and he quit his job, and like that was his leap. That was his like first leap, where he was like, I'm moving from Manhattan to Queens. I'm moving in with his then girlfriend, now wife. So like when an opportunity presented himself, and it was sort of the way the story goes. I haven't actually followed up on him with this, but I think the way the story goes is he was about to get offered a raise at the insurance company or quit and do comedy, and he sort of like took that leap.
Yeah.
So I feel confident that I won't rush into that. I know a lot of comics who work jobs that they hate, and they see that as a motivator to do more comedy. But for me, I know that like when I'm helping kids get into college or write an essay or whatever, I feel better about myself. So even at the end of the day, if the comedy sucked and I went on last at 12:30 for two people and they hated me, at least that day, like I helped somebody try to do something.
Yeah. And you've mentioned that you recently were showcased on The Moth, the NPR storytelling podcast. Do you feel like with the invention of the internet, storytelling has become more prolific? Do you think it has helped that in any way, or has it just been a sort of subsidiary effect? Has it had a genuine impact?
That's fascinating. I like to think it's had an impact because I think it's relatively well curated, those sort of popular storytelling things. And I think I've learned a lot about the world and been inspired by Moth stories and stories in general. There's a few that really stand out. There's one about the Blue Man Group that I just like listen to and I cry. And there's one about the Boston Marathon. A guy, Peter Sagal, ran the Boston Marathon, and he ran it as a guide with a blind person.
Wow.
That one, like, I listened to, like, and I ran the Boston Marathon mostly because of that story.
Wow.
So I like to think that, like, the really good stories will, like, stand out, and the popularity of it is really good. Like, The Moth or, like, any very popular podcast or organization like has its problems.
Mm-hmm.
The tickets are too expensive. There's no consistency to like the judging of like who wins or whatever. Like the story that you heard like did not win that night, but 3 years later they put it on the podcast. So like it's sort of, there are problems with it, but I think at its core there's some really great stories out there, more than I'll ever have time to listen to. But yeah, I think it's a net good. When I did the show, they put me on the podcast, I got a lot of random text messages from people who were just like, hey, like, I was listening to this. Like, my one friend, Emily, is a professional soccer player.
Mm-hmm.
And we hadn't talked in a couple of years, just like she's on the other side of the country. And she just sent me a message. She was like, hey, I was on the road and I listened to this. I was like, that is so cool.
Wow.
So the reach of it is really cool, too. It's definitely like the thing that I've done that's had the most reach. But as I was telling you before, I did that Moth story before I did comedy, like, seriously. And so, like, there's, like, one or two jokes in it, but I wouldn't say it's, like, a funny, funny story. It's more heartfelt. But now, you know, years later, I'm trying to really combine those things. So I'm trying to take my hardened stand-up chops that, like, I can tell jokes with the best of them in New York and, like, get up and get laughs, but also I have this, like, gear mm-hmm. that isn't always appreciated in New York that might be appreciated a little bit more over here. You know, I haven't had a ton of reviews or massive audiences, but the people that have seen it, I would say most people leave, like, feeling pretty good about it. Which
and that's how you build a cult following, or yes. indeed a cult.
Yes, yeah.
Should you want to go in that direction. Easier to monetize.
That would be, yeah, oh yeah, anything will make more money than this. As I like beg people to come in the hopes that they might give me a fiver, I was at the bar, and I don't drink, but I just stopped for a soda water, and I just looked up, and they were selling beers for £5, and I was just like, I'm in the wrong business. Like, I should be selling beer, because this is a much better business model than, like, here's this art I, like, slaved over for 2 years to make this, like, one story that, like, has jokes in it, and, like, you can make the same amount of money from selling, like,
but, like,
a Corona. Yeah.
Just don't dwell on that too much, because...
I know. You
can't afford therapy for...
well,
maybe if you start selling Bud Lights, perhaps.
If I start... Yes, I... Here's the thing. I can't afford therapy and I go anyway because it's important to me.
My final question is quite a broad one.
Yeah.
But how important is story to comedy?
How important is story to comedy?
Or narratives as a whole?
I would say I'm on the more traditional end of that spectrum. Of I like a story with a beginning, middle, and an end. But I think that in a lot of ways, like, all the great comedy is like a story. I even have started to think about even a tiny little bit that I do as like a little story. So I think at its core, all comedy is like a type of story. So, like, last night I saw a guy from New Zealand. He read a list of food tips for the fringe, and he said, here's a food tip for each letter of the alphabet. And he started with apples and bananas and slowly went through the whole list. And it felt like a story because he kept talking about eggs. It was like E for eggs, and then he would get to H for hard-boiled eggs, and then he would do, like, whatever. And he just kept bringing back eggs. And so even that, which is absurdist and bizarre and alternative, felt like a little bit of a story. And so I think it's fundamental to comedy. I'm sure there are people that would disagree with me on that, but I'm a believer in it. And even somebody like Bo Burnham, mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with his work.
Huge fan.
Yeah. His last special, Make Happy. Did mm-hmm. you watch? I watched that special and I thought, I can't believe other people are making comedy. Like, we're just wasting our time.
Yeah.
Because it was so incredible. And, you know, he's doing a Kanye bit about Pringles. And it feels like the most, like, intimate, personal story about, like, him having panic attacks that you could have. Now, it didn't fit. It wouldn't work on The Moth. it wouldn't work on, like, PBS's Story from the Stage. But in terms of just, like, communicating, this is, like, I've had panic attacks on stage before. This is, like, sort of approximating it, and it's sort of approximating the way I feel. This is, like, nobody can understand me, but also, like, I need to be up here. Mm. And I thought that communicated such a powerful, like, stories from his life and moments. So I would say at the end of the day, I'm so interested in good stories, and I also want them to be punchy. Like, I'm not one of these people that's like, it doesn't need to be funny. Like, when I get up there, sometimes on this part of the world, because there's so much storytelling, sometimes I'm like, I need more jokes. Like, you're sort of taking advantage of my generous listening by not giving me more punchlines.
Mm. The reward.
Yeah, give me the reward a little bit. Keep me interested. Keep me guessing as you tell the story. That being said, like, I do lean on the story side where... That feels like a minority. I mean, I'm living with five comics, and of the three of us who are here who have solo shows, or like hours of just us doing stand-up, they're all narrative arcs, and we feel, I'll speak for all of us, for Brett and for Sam, sort of like, oh, like, what we're doing is different than every other comic in New York. or in Boston, where Brad is from, that we're doing something like a little bit more ambitious, a little bit more theatrical, but also very us. Mm. Like Sam's show is about sleeping with dads, and Brett's show is about being polyamorous, and my show is about starting comedy after my best friend and my girlfriend got together in Edinburgh. So like all these stories are very personal to us, but they're also combining all the do a 10-minute set, do a 10-minute bit of stand-up. So for me, it's fundamental, and I just hope more people see the show, I guess, because I've been working so hard on this one story for so long, and it combines such little 5-minute pieces of the Moss story, 5-minute pieces of other stories, to get there.
Well, I sincerely hope they do too, because it sounds phenomenal. I can't wait to see it myself.
Oh, thanks.
And I hope it goes from strength to strength, and you get to tour it, and more people get to see it. And
oh, that'd be cool.
The Netflix series / special.
I think I'm going to record it myself at some point. My friend Kevin James Doyle, who's another comic you should check out, his show's at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. He did a show called 30-Year-Old Virgin.
Okay.
He, 2 years ago at the Fringe, about he was engaged and Christian, and then they broke up when he was 29, and suddenly he was like going to be a 30-year-old virgin.
Mm.
And but the show is so much more than that. Like, it's just great storytelling. And I randomly went to his taping. He taped it with three cameras at a church basement in New York City, and right. I don't know how I saw it, somewhere on Twitter, somewhere, and I just showed up Friday night, and he killed for an hour, and I was like, this is amazing. And he's like, yeah, man, I recorded it myself. Like, I don't know what I'm going to do with it yet, but I see myself in the next, in 2 years, I want to do The Fringe again. By that time, I hope to have recorded this thing, and put it up somewhere, on my website, donate $5, whatever it will be.
Yeah.
But it's cool to have, by the end of this journey of the show, I'll have one data point of like an artistic thing that I've made. And I just heard Birbiglia and this guy, Brian Koppelman, who's a screenwriter, talk about like the second thing you make is really important, because it creates a line from the first thing you make to the second thing. And you start to have your own language and your own sort of universe that you've created. So I'm really excited. I mean, I got to get through this one first, but I'm really excited to see like what that next one might be, and what story I want to tell, because this one is so fundamental. This is like my origin story as a comedian and sort of as an adult. It's like the first sad thing that happened to me when I was 22. So I don't know where the next one will be, but I know that the process will be similar in that it's just like jokes and stories and just like marrying them together.
Well, I can't wait to see it too.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's been such a pleasure. Good luck with the show. You have such good guests. Listen to the other ones. If for some reason you started with mine before you listened to Anna Dresden's, go back and listen to her. She's on Saturday Night Live. Or she writes for Saturday Night Live.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, man. Thank you.